I speak to Isabel de Citra, who runs a venture capital investment company in Asia and Europe. They invest in future food technology, animal tech, and food tech. Isabel provides some very interesting insights into what they look for in a startup, the technology, the product, and the people. So if you're a company looking for investment or an investor looking for a company, then listen on. I'm Alex Crisp, and welcome to another episode of Future Foods Interviews. This episode, like all previous episodes, can be found on all major podcast platforms, and the video is on YouTube. So, nice to meet you, Isabel de Citra. Is that how I say your name?
You can say it this way. Hi, Alex. Very nice to be with you. I would pronounce it the French way, de Citre, but it's fine.
Citra. De Citra. Okay. Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show. You are the founder of ID Capital, which is a boutique venture capital consulting company. And you focus your investments mostly on startups working in the sort of sustainable future of food, working on kind of challenges of feeding a growing population.
Exactly.
Is that about right?
Absolutely. We are investing and we are advising other types of investors in whatever relates to the future of food. And we have a very strong spin on Asia Pacific, but half of what we are doing is global in nature.
Okay. And you are based in Singapore, but you are French.
I'm French, and you know, find me in London, my new place that I call home for the past 2 years.
Oh, you're in London now, are you?
I am, after okay. 10 years in Singapore.
Ah, okay. Okay. So let's start off by saying, how do you choose the companies that you invest in, the startups that you invest in, and how do you make sure that they align with your own ethos on kind of environment and sustainability, etc.?
You know, we are guided by very simple principles. We invest in the future of food for a more sustainable future. And we try to stick to very basic principles, and it's difficult. Why? Because you're always carried away by enthusiastic founders. In essence, we want to invest in people bringing defensible solutions to big problems in the food and agri chain. Every word is important. And you need to be very disciplined to bring it to life. You need to be disciplined, analytical, and to some extent dispassionate, which might be a bit contradictory. We are very passionate about building the future of food, but when it comes to investing, our approach is very rooted in science and tech. There are other ways to build defensibility, like branding. Maybe I've been too much into branding for the previous 20 years of my career. I just believe being grounded in science and tech creates more adaptable businesses, things that you can export overseas. And it kind of makes a case for B2B businesses, in essence, more than B2C. I think international expansion is less hindered by the complexities of cultural differences. So we are investing across the agri-food tech value chain, as you have heard me saying again and again, in technology. And we try to steer clear of the hype as much as it's possible. I will give you a very simple example. After doing investment as early as in 2014 in alternative proteins, we've actually pulled back from investing in oil proteins when we felt like the noise drowned out the signal. And now we are getting back in.
When you felt like the noise, what? Sorry, can you say that again? When you felt...
I would say the noise to signal ratio, to take a bit of an image, was a bit wrong. And the hype was exceeding reasonable expectations you can put behind old proteins. Don't get me wrong. I think the topic of feeding a growing population within planetary boundaries is a very important one. And we don't yet have all the solutions. So alternative proteins are part of it. They are very, very needed. But at some point of time, it's gone too far. And when I mean it's gone too far, I'm old enough to have seen a couple of bubbles in the market, and this was one of them, definitely. So as soon as we started to smell like, and the signal is when everybody talks about it and everybody has an opinion on it, then you can tell something is going too far. So at that point of time, we kept looking and we looked at the sector very, very carefully. We are still on top of what's happening. But if you look at the last 8 investments we've made, they were not in oil proteins. No, we are resuming investment in the sector.
So which sector are you choosing instead of alt proteins mainly?
Oh, there is no mainly. Actually, we've been investing across the value chain. We have invested in animal farming tech, probably not the most glamorous topic these days, because there would be people willing to think that we are moving to the post-animal economy, like the think tank called RethinkX refers to. I don't believe so. I'm coming from Asia. I don't believe Asia will drop and will give up on animal proteins anytime soon. Both are needed. I like to call all protein complementary protein, which is a better way to call it. So we've been investing in animal farming tech recently. We are closing another one in animal farming tech. We've been investing in biologicals, biological input. We've been also investing in a couple of startups that has a lot of crossover across different industries. One of them being, for instance, Allozymes, based in Singapore. It's a synthetic biology platform that is engineering and designing enzymes with a very high throughput. Applications can be in food, and they are in food, but it's also in green chemistry and in many other domains. They recently, just as an example, they recently inked two major deals. One is with Adisseo, the feed additive company, part of ChemChina. The other one is with Syensqo, the spin-off of Solvay, the specialty chemistry division of Solvay. And this will be for applications in personal care. Another one we've done, it's called Sepure Technologies. It's a filtration solution for solvent recovery. And again, it does apply beautifully to the edible oil sector, wherein you can really count on massive energy reduction with this process. So it's kind of a decarbonization solution at large, but it also applies to semiconductors and to many other industries. We quite like these startups where they have an angle, they have a very strong value proposition for food and ag, but it doesn't mean it's exclusive of others and other sectors.
Okay, so you think that your belief is that sort of alt proteins, including I suppose cultivated meats and dairy etc. and precision fermentation and the likes, you think that is a bubble of sorts?
Like in any bubble, the fundamentals are very strong. Bubbles never come out of nowhere. I think the kind of valuations we've seen over the last few years in this sector were the typical signals of a bubble. But don't get me wrong, I think the sector is here to stay. And I go even one step further. Even the plant-based meat sector, or the plant-based protein sector, to be more specific, that some of the investors would call dead or semi-dead. I don't believe it's dead at all. I think there is going to be a reset. Some businesses will suffer, some will survive and come out stronger. But I think the trend is here to stay. What we might not see is the kind of growth year on year that we have seen over the past years, but I think it's definitely here to stay. And if you want to delve into all proteins, then we need to be very more specific, subsector by subsector. I don't have the same stance on plant-based proteins than I have on microalgae or precision fermentation or cultivated meat.
Okay, so which and so you think plant-based meats is a higher growth sector, or which, and so which of those do you think is has the most chance for growth over the next 5 years, would you say?
Plant-based protein will grow. Whether it's a VC game is more of a question. And I think we have invested in a chickpea protein technology called InnovoPro, a very good one. Clearly, The reason why they stand and they resist the test of time is because their market is not solely into plant-based meat replacement. They're also entering into domains where there is a need for what they're doing, functional ingredients, specialty ingredients. So this sort of value proposition, I believe in it very, very much. However, there are way too many plant-based chicken nuggets on the market, way too many. Why would consumers pay up to 40% premium for something that is not as good as the original one? I think there is a reinvention process at stake, but if you ask me, plant-based proteins are absolutely needed and here to stay. Other growth areas, precision fermentation, absolutely. Coming from Asia, we've been the one making a lot of noise around this for the past 3 years, saying that Asia is rising to the opportunity, and you can see it coming in multiple countries, not just Singapore. And I really believe this sector is going to be very resilient. We are about to invest in a startup in that space. We haven't done any investment so far. So I really believe very strongly about it. Cultivated meat is a bit more of a conundrum because fundamentally, as much as it's the most intellectually exciting part of the all alternative protein gamut, to my taste, it doesn't fundamentally fit very well the VC mold, given the timelines and the level of technology risk behind this. Said differently, the technology can work. It's not as if it were science fiction, but the business model underpinning it is far from being proven. And I quite don't know for how long venture investors can support it when eventually it might be more of a geopolitical game from different countries willing to acquire self-sufficiency in their meat production.
I mean, I suppose it's also a kind of social acceptance as well, isn't it? It's about whether people are happy to eat that sort of thing.
And when everything is said and done, you're right to say that we still haven't gotten a very clear idea of whether the consumers would like it. Anything you can do before the product is available on the market is nice, is lovely, but it doesn't tell you much. You know, when you do polls or surveys, consumer surveys, and people haven't experienced the product, they may very well tell you what they think reflects well on them. But it doesn't mean that on the day when they would be facing the option on the supermarket, they would buy it actually. Quite surely, prescription channels will be what we call the on-trade, so on-premise restaurants and places like this. But and nobody's to blame for it. We just don't have a very good sense of the consumer offtake and likelihood to buy as yet, and it will just take time to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the exact statistics, but I think Bryant Research did some investigations into this, and it was I think there was surprisingly more people were willing to try cultivated meat than perhaps we would
Which
imagine.
is a very positive signal, absolutely. Then trying is one thing. Buying again, repeat purchase is a very different beast. We've seen this with plant-based meat. Many people tried, they were genuinely interested in it, but they didn't buy again and again.
So, are you invested in any cultivated meat companies, or
No, we are not.
you're
We
not?
are not. And for reasons we can quite easily explain. We are very driven by the science part of things and by the capacity to see a clear pathway to commercialization, which I'm yet to see in cultivated meat. There are many people doing extremely interesting and commendable work on the technology. As much as it's complex, it doesn't mean it has a market value that is proven yet. So for me, it's still a question mark. I don't know what I don't know, but I think I don't believe it's fundamentally something that the venture capital industry can support for the longest term. It needs to be, as I said, preempted by different types of players, not people having an exit window of time of 3 years in 5 years, like VC funds operate usually when they have LPs. The majority of them have LPs. So it's always said that they need patient capital, but where do you find patient capital at that level of funding with a level of risk at stake? Not very easy. The equation is quite difficult. You can find patient capital, you can find risk capital, but when people start to ask for $400 million to build a plant with bioreactors, it's a whole different game. DSM can invest $400 million in a fermentation plant and bioreactors because they know their trade, they know how to operate it. But the conjunction of all these risks is quite unheard of. And at the end of the day, it's food. The price cannot just go very high.
It's clearly going to need for this industry to really take off, it's going to need some government, it's going to need substantial government support, isn't it? I know Lane Clark from the Good Food Institute was talking in sort of tens of billions of dollars a year needs to be invested.
Yeah, and we tend to not invest in startups where the prerequisite to have a solid business case is that externalities will be priced in, like, GHG emissions and likes, because it's a very, very bold assumption. It may just never happen in the 10 next 10 years.
Okay, so you clearly have some companies that are doing well. Which are your kind of highest performing, which are your most successful companies that you've invested in, and what's the product that they sell that's good for the planet and sustainability?
It depends on how you define success. If success means exits, we don't have any yet. And it will take a few years, and that's probably the big penalty of the agri-food tech sector, in that we haven't shown exits to the tune of what investors would like to see to be confident in the sector. It will take some time. I'm confident on the longer term, but very, very few successful exits have given confidence in a wider of investors. So what I could call a success would be a bit of a proxy of a success. For me, it's more about the strategic agility of the founders and their capacity to really address real problems. The second thing I would call a success is related to how we operate at ID Capital. So let me delve into one and then the other one. Success stories, the way I can define them at best today, take Insect. Why Insect? The French company farming insect. The need is there, and over time they've managed to develop a very inclusive value proposition, building on the concept of circularity. So they started off with this promise of developing a feed alternative to remove the volatility of fish meal in the equation of feed. Today they are able to address feed, pet food, human food, biologicals, biofertilizer, biostimulants, and there is more to come. And it's what it takes to be successful. I'm always very scared when I see people developing a startup, biotransforming a biomass into something else, like in that case, it can be food waste into proteins, and valorizing a portion of it. They've managed to make it very holistic. And so you could call them a protein company. You could also call them a bio input company. That's the beauty of it. I spoke about Halozymes. When you start to be at the stage where you can deliver value to a Syensqo and an Adisseo on the feed sector, the personal care sector, the skincare sector, you're onto something very big. And keep in mind, if the future economy, the green economy, is a bio-based economy, we will need enzymes. We will need high-performing enzymes with good selectivity, with good yields, because who doesn't sit on a biomass and sees this as a golden mine because it's so rich in nutrients, proteins, peptides, you name it? You can always convert a biomass into something else. It's technically and chemically speaking feasible. Very often the issue is the yield. Does it pay? Does the processing and the CapEx and the OpEx pays for what you can sell on the market? Very often, these processes are enabled by catalyst and enzymes. And if your enzyme can increase the yield in a significant manner, suddenly what was non-economical can become economical. So I really like this platform plays because if one market is not going well at a given point of time, they can shift gears and they can pivot to another one.
Okay.
This is the way I would define success so far. We are fortunate to have a solid portfolio. And yes, these are more difficult times for startups, but some of them are really doing well. Then there is another way to define impact, which is a bit more personal to me. Yes, we are investors. I'm investing as a private investor, so call it a family office if you will. But if it were only this, maybe we wouldn't even be on the call today. We are like a family office that has decided to punch above its weight and have more impact than what we can have on our own capital. So, as you rightly mentioned at the very beginning, we are a boutique investment and advisory company, and we advise much bigger investors. My financial KPI would be my P&L and my return, but my mental KPI is the impact we can trigger, nudging much bigger players in a given direction for a more sustainable food future. And we've done it first and foremost on Asia Pacific as being a bit of the hunting ground I decided to take when I decided to develop this additional leg of my business in 2016. But Asia is such a big beast, whatever we can do in Asia will have a ripple effect on the rest of the world. And we do it through a platform called Future Food Asia. I'm not here to do the promotion of Future Food Asia, but it's really, if you're asking, since you're asking me how I define impact, that's how I would define it. Embarking many other players into thinking that the future of food should keep them busy. It can be any VC investor who's not wedded to agri-food and who should consider from now on that investing in agri-food tech just makes good common sense. It's a business.
So you've been concentrated in Asia for quite a few years now. So what takes you to London? Is that for personal reasons or is that sort of business led?
This was first driven by personal reasons, absolutely. Then I looked at how I could make it an opportunity, even if it was not a business decision first and foremost. The team is in Singapore and in China since 21, and I was the one relocating. So we realized that Europe needs large markets. Europe doesn't have large markets. If you like technology and innovation, honestly, which is my case, honestly, Europe is like a toy store. You're absolutely spoiled, but the big growing markets are not here. So I would say the opportunities of bringing innovations from Europe to Asia are real, and that's something that also keeps us busy.
Okay. So you think of London as a good place to sort of direct these markets and to operate from. I mean, has London got a good reputation in this area particularly?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. What I see is a lot of innovation in the UK, not just London, but a lot of innovation. Lots of investors in London, for sure. So people come to the UK. The innovation I've seen in the UK is superb in terms of academic credibility and nimbleness is absolutely superb. And I dare say, as a French person, don't smile, because of Brexit, the UK is even more keen on considering Asian expansion as a potential, commercial destiny, since the European market are clearly a bit less friendly than before to UK startups.
Okay, so when you're deciding on a company to invest in, I mean, how much of that depends on the products, and how much of that depends on the people behind the products, the kind of founders and that sort of thing. And what sort of thing are you looking for in the people that you invest in?
It's a very good question. If there were a simple answer, my job would be very simple, which it is not. So the reality is the first thing you see is the product and the technology. That's how startups come to you. They describe themselves as cracking that problem with this solution, with this technology. In reality, in the end, you invest in people. But the first filter is, do I believe in their assessment of the problem to solve and their technology to do it? So it's a bit of a, I would say it's a pendulum swing between doing a due diligence on the technology, and I can delve into how we approach this, and in the end, being taking the final decision based on how you feel the team will go through the ups and downs, because there will be ups and downs. Nothing will ever happen as per their plan, and you know it, and somehow they know it, but you need to start somewhere. So it's highly people dependent. We are investing in Series A startup, so most of the time pre-revenue. And if they have revenue, these are non-recurring revenues, like one-off R&D projects of sorts. As you can imagine, it's extremely risky. In the end, what makes it stick are people. But in terms of amount of time spent on the due diligence, the technology is a very big part of it, because that's really where you can put your fingers and try to turn data and look at what they're doing and how they're doing it and how different it is from the others.
So do you what I mean, when you invest in companies, because you say that you're also a consulting company as well, so you do you kind of get involved with the day-to-day business of the companies that you invest in? Do you kind of get involved with the management and that kind of thing?
Not with the day-to-day, never. And if ever I think it would be needed, and I run away, because it's not possible. It's absolutely not possible. We want to have strong founders and strong management teams. We don't want people to be spoon-fed. And I go by the lines of Vinod Khosla, who said in a very memorable interview that 90% of board members should be forbidden to sit on the board of startup because they have no qualified experience to do so, and they are destroying value. They are not even neutral, in his opinion. They are destroying value. So our value add is to be very connected with the industry. That's how and why startups want to work with us and get our investment. It's not just the money, all the money is important. It's also what we can bring to them. So going around your question somehow, I would say sometimes we realize that the problem statement, as seen by the entrepreneur, is not exactly what keeps corporate executives awake at night. We have a portfolio company working on precision feeding and health monitoring. And it was all good. I really thought it was a strong use case. It's not a bad one, but what really the industry is after is an end-to-end traceability tool. Luckily, they can deliver. But it's only when you accept to confront your idea with the reality of the market that you can build the business. The other thing we look at, and again, it's a way to do a due deal on the tech, but also on the people, is the freedom to operate. I've been surprised, consistently surprised, notably in precision fermentation, but and to some extent on cultivated meat, how people are a little ignorant on this notion of freedom to operate. And I have to say, on balance, the reading patents and going down a rabbit hole is getting more and more difficult. You know, in patent law, the validity of a patent doesn't depend on whether the invention has been reduced to practice, but to some extent, it tells you a lot about whether it would be standing the test of time. When you see the litigation between Perfect Day and Fonterra on the patent from Perfect Day on manufacturing dairy alternatives, and when you look at how Fonterra managed to win the lawsuit, saying that the patent doesn't disclose enough to reproduce the results that are claimed in the patent by just using the processes described in the patent. When you read all this carefully, you quite wonder how the patent was granted in the first place. And the reality is, when you do due diligence on startups, sometimes it's a very virgin, clean slate. There is little IP activity, and we quite like it. We've just invested in a startup in Malaysia who is doing quantum carbon dot sorry carbon quantum dots for photosynthesis enhancement. There is very little IP activity in that space, but sometimes it's very crowded. And so when you have lots and lots of patents, it's very tempting to be impressed by who owns the highest number of patents. But the reality is many don't have much value. Yes, it's patentable. It doesn't mean it has a very strong value, either in terms of blocking competitors or in terms of securing an advantage on the market.
Okay. So I wasn't aware of this legal case between Perfect Day and Fonterra. So clearly, I mean, that's a bit of a sort of David and Goliath kind of case, isn't it? And
Yeah, but in the Bible, David wins. And
yeah.
I'm not sure that's the case. Yeah.
And Fonterra did win the
Far.
case then.
So far.
So
Yeah.
and so they owned, obviously they owned the patent, which they thought that Perfect Day was breaching. Is that how it works?
No. They challenged the patent that Perfect Day was had filed, and
Okay.
it creates a precedent, to the best of my knowledge, in Australia, from where they could potentially escalate and challenge the patent in different jurisdictions. What
Okay.
is at stake for Perfect Day? The capacity to keep the patent.
Okay. All right. I might have to look into that a bit further.
And we can have a separate discussion on this
Okay.
when
Yeah.
you have time.
Yeah,
Yeah,
sure.
in
So,
that sense, I think these are very complex topics. Cultivated meat is no less complex. We've spent, for somebody who hasn't invested in cultivated meat, just because we wanted to check whether we were missing on something very big, we've spent a ridiculous amount of time understanding the space, reading literature, reading techno-economic analysis. And, at the end of the day, we can spend our days reading very interesting publications and talking to very, very interesting people, but it's not a business. I like to go by something that Warren Buffett said a long time ago. It's brutally simple, but he used to say that when he sorts business opportunities, namely investment opportunities, he has three piles: the good ones, the bad ones, and those who are too complex.
Okay.
Very interesting. He doesn't say the middle one are yes, maybes. That's not what he said. He said, yes, I can investigate. No, it doesn't make sense. And the other ones, it's just too complex. So we focus on opportunities within our circle of competence, and we try to grow this competence over time, but we're also very aware that there are things when we don't understand, we don't go ahead.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose it's that comes down a lot of the time to the management of the company. If they can't explain what they do in a way that can be kind of relatively easily understood, then perhaps it's not the technology itself, perhaps it's their ability to communicate it.
Yeah, in the end, we would prefer an exceptional team with an okay technology than a potentially Nobel Prize winning technology with no business plan behind. Clearly.
So I suppose a lot of the companies you invest in, they are startups. There will be a lot of scientists in running these companies, starting them. You know, they would have come out of perhaps kind of academic kind of research. So they might not have this sort of business acumen that is required to grow these businesses. So do you help in that regard?
Part of the investors we have invested in are coming from the academic world with PhDs and likes, but only part of them. When you're dealing with, I would say, digital innovation, this is not deep tech. This is tech, but it is not deep tech. It's not needed to come from the academia. So that's the first thing. We have also serial entrepreneurs like X-Sites Digital in Australia doing pig farming technology, serial entrepreneur, Allozymes. The founder is also a serial entrepreneur. We are going to invest in this precision fermentation startup out of Australia, serial entrepreneur. It's a very strong element of confidence. Then back to your point, would we invest in a mad scientist startup? No. I love science. I'm
Yeah.
coming from a background.
Okay.
It's a different bent of mind. You know what I have noticed? Every single country, at least the ones that I lived in, France, Germany, Singapore, the UK. At some point of time, when you deal with universities and research centers, they come to you and they say, can you help me have a better success rate in tech transfer? We want to have more spin-offs.
Mm.
Give me the name of one university who doesn't want to have more unicorns stemming from their research. Unicorns are exceptions. Successful entrepreneurs are exceptions. What all these entities are trying to do is to force-fit scientists into entrepreneurs. Sometimes it works, but again, it's an exception. So we cannot build a process on things which are a bit more random, empirical, and an exception if you look by numbers. One of the things I like to mention is if you expose a scientific founder to the reality of what business development means at an early stage of their venture, they will freak out because it's not intellectually rewarding for people like them. Business development is a lot of trying to knock at many doors, and most of them will not even open. And when once the door open, you need to chase people forever because you're one out of 65 projects they have on their desk, and you're small and they're big, and your time is not their time. So the day-to-day of a BD person, whether it's the CEO or a higher person in a team, if you're hardwired to do research and your brain starts to activate when you're dealing with complex things, you might find the day-to-day of business development extremely boring and not at your level. And very often you would cut corners and say, product is there, it's amazing, it will sell by itself. Show me one product that sells by itself. There isn't. So I think it's not just that they are not smart enough or not good enough to do business development. It's sometimes that for them it's alien, like they don't even understand what is to be done. It should sell.
Yes, well, it's not what interests them in the first place, is it? You know, what
Yeah.
it was the science that was why they ended up there. So, I mean, I suppose as a venture capitalist, you have your successes and failures. You know, in order to be truly 100% successful, you have to be able to kind of see into the future, really, don't you? And read the future very carefully, so clearly there are risks involved in this kind of investment. So what are the biggest risks and challenges in this industry, particularly?
Venture investing is very risky. Investing in early stage startups pre-revenue, like we do, is even more risky. Investing in domains like agri-food, where margins are only so big, and where gestation times and consumer behaviors are, well, gestation times are long and consumer behaviors don't change fast, they never change fast, is extremely risky. At the moment, risk for startup is to run out of cash. And I think the best thing I can say is that they need to find a way to prove their business case quite early. It doesn't matter if they still burn cash, but at least they need to show there is a business case. Having a business case means very simple things: being able to sell something with a positive gross margin. That's it. Then the EBITDA will be negative for another 3, 4 years. Fine. But how many startups have we seen? The more they sell, the more they lose money just because the gross margin is negative.
I mean, clearly, when you invest, you need to have a good return. So because you are taking such big risks, I suspect your return is fivefold or tenfold. What sort of return would you expect on your investment?
When the interest rates were very low, you could get by with a 12-15% return because that's the best you could. Well, the alternatives were not great. Let's put it this way. Know that the interest rates are nice and you can get a 5% return with absolutely no risk or almost no risk. Then you're a bit more hungry with your VC investment. And I would say quite traditionally, you would look for 20% IRR. We are not a fund. We are not managing third-party money, so I have the luxury of being able to be very patient. And also, and it's my personal spin, the theory of venture fund management is that one unicorn will pay for all the losses and for the ones that will barely be returning the money. I'm not in that mindset. I'm not chasing unicorns. If one of them in my portfolio is, I'm absolutely delighted. But I prefer to have, out of the 14 investments we've made, I prefer to have 10 that are doing good to great, because the way we work and the way they will have impact at scale is my most important KPI. Yeah, we want to make money to be able to reinvest the proceeds into others, absolutely. But we also want to make sure that's the right thing to do. I don't know what to think of funds who've made their entire performance on having exited beyond meat in due course. And I know a few of them. Good. These are smart people. They've managed the money smartly. But what does it mean? Today, Beyond Meat doesn't deliver a massive impact to the planet. And yet the fund can pride themselves of having maybe a 40% IR. Fundamentally, I have this question mark. I don't know what to make of it, because for me, that's not what I call impact.
Right. Okay. So when you invest in companies, you clearly you take a percentage of their of the company. So you might you would put a value on a company, and then you'd invest a certain amount kind of based on that value. You would take like 5% or 10% of the company. Is that how it works?
That's exactly how it works. We are a small investor. I don't mind saying that we are a minority investor in Series A company. So we are usually not leading rounds. It does happen sometimes that we syndicate rounds and we bring in other investors bigger than us. We have this very unique relationship with the industry. So we know how to build partnerships and collaborations of reciprocal value add for the startups and the bigger partner. You know, it's such a value proposition that over the last 3 weeks, I was thinking of it before taking the call with you. Over the past 3 weeks, we've been called by four startups we are not investors in to help them with partnerships. And the way they would reward us would be probably a mix of, fees and sweat equity, because that's how it works these days. But that's really defining us. So I like to promote my portfolio, but I also know there is more to it. Like, it's not because I haven't invested in a startup that I don't think it's a good one. Maybe it was a good one, but they didn't want to have an investment from us. Maybe the timing was not good. Maybe we found the valuation too high, and so on and so forth.
So in that early kind of negotiation period, you can you would you because obviously the companies don't want to give away too much equity in their startups, and so there will be a period of negotiation where some push and pull at that point. Yes.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when there is a will, there is a way. And you can also, the process of negotiating with a startup for me is an extension of the due diligence. You see how people behave. This is business. There are, of course, different kind of stakes and interests in the discussion. But seeing how people behave in critical situation is very, very telling. It gives you an indication of how they will deal with the day-to-day stress of endless negotiation with bigger investors one day.
Yeah, interesting. So, what do you see? I mean, how do you see the markets changing over the next 5 years? I mean, we've had a slowdown, I suppose, haven't we, over the last sort of 3 or 4 years. Do you see this changing? Do you see it picking up over the next 5 years?
I think it will go back to something a bit more exciting. I'm very confident. A year ago, I was not so confident, maybe because I could see the transactions still happening at a very speedy pace with valuations that in many cases didn't make much sense to me. But the rest of the market, not just the venture capital market in agri-food, was crumbling. So I could see the disconnect. I think what the sector is looking at the moment, the private sector is looking at places where innovation meets growth. By the way, we are preparing the ninth edition of our annual conference in May in Singapore. That's how we've called the conference, where innovation meets growth. Innovation is needed. Innovation has always been exciting, but you need growth. So, what do I see? Generally speaking, and I'm not going to be very provide a very itemized answer to your question, anything that relates to soil health, I think will gain momentum, which means technically agri-tech will probably take a little bit of precedence over food tech to some extent. I think pathways to profitability will be required by investors. So they will be, we will see more startups with, I would say, phased strategies, whereby you can address a reasonably big market to get started, maybe not the dream market, but at least something to start with. And then when you get more credentials, you can get more money for CapEx and you can address bigger markets. We've seen this on the startup I'm referring to in precision fermentation. Orgy Foods from Australia is exactly on this pathway. They will start with lactoferrin, a low level of inclusion ingredient of high value, and then they'll go into casein, which is a much bigger play. But the investments behind are commensurate with the size of the addressable market. I think also what is going to change the landscape is the awareness that some challenges cannot be only solved by the private sector. And thus, some innovations don't really fit the VC mold. You've heard me saying this three times. Generally speaking, anything that is too reliant on pricing externalities in. The other thing I see, which I'm happy and scared at the same time, I think biological, so biological input to replace chemistries, you can see them trending at the moment. Every time we talk to a private equity investor, so normally those people come after the VC funding period has ended and they come in to support the growth of startup. So these people are very telling in their what they like and dislike is very important for earlier stage investors. We see biologicals being the new talk of the town. Everybody would like to find a deal in biologicals, all of them. However, I'm a bit scared that it could become another mini bubble. Why? Because when too much money is chasing too few opportunities, that's what you have. And also, specific to biologicals, unlike alternative proteins, the addressable market of each startup is only so big. These are businesses that could be eventually reaching the level of 100, 200 million. Not bad, not small, but these are not billions.
No.
And also, there is the sticky question of the exits. Because of the concentration of corporate players in the space with the mergers and the lay of the land, if you compare it to medical biotech, which is very often a point of comparison, where you have dozens of exit options for every single startup, that's not the case in agriculture. So yes, there is great momentum around biologicals. I'm just afraid that it could fall flat, and I don't wish it because biologicals are very much needed. And then there is the buzzword of AI. You know, when I studied in agri-food tech, if you wanted a chance to pique investors' curiosity, you would add IoT in many places of your deck. 5 years in, you would add machine learning. 2 years in, AI, I know it's generative AI.
I want to ask you one last question. It's been great talking to you, Isabel. But as a final question, I just wanted you to say to give some advice to entrepreneurs, people kind of starting up in ventures, startup companies. What kind of advice would you give to entrepreneurs?
The simple one. In the end of the day, success is people related. They need to know that nothing will happen as per their plans. And they need to know that we all know this. A plan is needed, but nothing will happen. So they will have to pivot and pivot and pivot. Startups are chaos. If you don't like it, don't join a startup. So for founders, my message would be hire people who can thrive in this environment. In the last 10 years, you had many people living a very cozy corporate life for the romance of startup, but that was romance. That's not the reality. And so, as a founder, you need to be ready to think that maybe the people you need on day one won't be the people you need on year two, but you always need to have a heads up. You need to have in your team people that you need to execute the next 2 years. You cannot be too short on the human resources side to the point that you just have the doers that you need today. You also need to have the people taking you to the next stage. And that is difficult.
And I suppose at that stage as well, you can't really afford the best, you know, you it's not like you can go to the established companies and kind of buy some of the people that work there to sort of come and help you establish yours. You know, you have to rely on paying smaller amounts for.
Yes, but absolutely. But I have to say, maybe it's for the best because you cannot have it all. People with fairly comfortable compensations leaving their job to go to a startup and getting all the benefits, all the upsides, and no downsides haven't proven that they will survive the most difficult moment of the company. The first thing is the alignment and the objective. I'm not saying people joining a startup should take a pay cut and live with it happily. What I'm just saying is, I've seen countless examples where a founder builds a very good chemistry with some scientific people or some people of very high caliber that they cannot afford on their payroll. If there is a will, there is a way. They will figure it out.
Yes. Okay. Well, I have to go, Isabel. That has been a wonderful interview. Thank you so much for
Thank you,
talking.
Alex. Thanks for your time.
I hope to talk to you again in the future. Thank you very much.